Hello and welcome to the AAMFT podcast, your all-access pass to the latest news, developments, and thought leaders in the world of systemic therapy, where we strive to relate, educate, and innovate one episode at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Eli Karam, and we're brought to you by the American Association for Marriage and Family Therapy. In addition to featuring unique conversation and interviews with established experts, our show provides information and education on direct practice and emerging trends in the MFT profession. For more information, please visit us at aamft.org. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Step inside, take a seat, let's explore the world of therapy like never before. Dr. Eli's here, bringing voices so bright, innovating, relating, and shedding new light. It's AAMFT, where wisdom meets passion. Come listen and see, talking trends, deep insights, and stories so bold. For MFT minds, the future unfolds. Systemic, my friends, we relate, educate, and innovate again. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. Stay systemic, my friends. We relate, educate, and innovate again, one episode at a time. At a time.
For those of us working in the trenches of couple and family therapy, we know that traditional approaches, while valuable, sometimes fall short when addressing the complex interplay of power, emotion, and social context that shapes our clients' relationships. We've all had those moments in session where we sense there's something deeper at work, something that goes beyond communication patterns or attachment styles, something that touches the very core of how partners relate to each other within a broader social systems that they inhabit. This is precisely where socio-emotional relationship therapy, or as we'll call today, CERT for short, emerges as a game changer. CERT represents a unique integration of systemic thinking with cutting-edge research on emotion, power dynamics, and social justice. See, it's not just another therapeutic model. It's a comprehensive framework that helps us understand how societal forces infiltrate the most intimate of spaces in our clients' lives, and more importantly, how we can work with couples to create genuine transformation that honors both individual emotional needs and relational equity. What makes CERT particularly compelling for us as systemically oriented therapists is its sophisticated understanding of how macro-level social forces, I'm talking about things like gender expectations, cultural narratives about relationships, economic pressures, and systemic inequalities, how all those things become embedded in the micro interactions between couples and families. Today, I have the tremendous privilege of speaking with return guest, Dr. Carmen Nussin-Martin, one of the pioneering developers of CERT. Carmen brings a unique combination of clinical expertise, research acumen, and social justice awareness to her work. She spent decades, as she'll tell us today, studying how power operates in intimate relationships. And she's been instrumental in developing therapeutic approaches that don't just help couples communicate, but actually help them restructure their relationship in ways that promote emotional intimacy and relational justice. What I find particularly compelling about Carmen's work and this model is that she's managed to create something that's deeply practical, which we'll talk about today, with specific interventions and techniques that we can use in our sessions, and profoundly theoretical, grounded in sophisticated understanding of system theory, feminist therapy principles, and emotion-focused approaches. So today we'll start out by diving into the foundational principles of CERT, how it conceptualizes the intersection of emotion and social power in intimate relationship. So this isn't just about helping our clients. It's about examining our own roles as therapists and how we can practice in ways that challenge rather than inadvertently reinforce problematic power dynamics. One thing I want to emphasize before we start the interview with Carmen, and I think this conversation is particularly timely as our field continues to grapple with questions of cultural responsiveness, social justice. Approaches like CERT offer us ways to honor both the clinical sophistication we've developed as systemic individual couple and family therapists and the growing awareness that therapy cannot be divorced from its social and political context. Carmen's work reminds us that the personal is indeed political, but it also shows us concrete ways to work with that reality in our clinical practice that's not constraining, it's actually free. I thoroughly enjoyed this interview, and I know you will too. Back after our talk with Carmen. Eli, back with you on the podcast. And Carmen, welcome back. And today we are going to be talking about your life's work, your model you're calling social emotional relationship therapy, or CERT, as we'll call it today. So for our listeners, they may be experienced with various models of couple and family therapy, but tell us about the origin of CERT and what makes it distinct from other MFT models.
Thank you, Eli. I'm so honored to be here and to be able to share this work. What started my practice of couple therapy and family therapy in the late 80s, we did not talk very much about gender or power. And I started working on studying couples that were not clinical couples, but just studying how gender, culture, and power were playing out in their relationships. And I worked with a woman, Anne Mahoney, and she's a sociologist, and was really fascinated by what we were finding in the work that I was doing with my couples as well. What we found is that most of the people that we were interviewing had egalitarian ideals, but when we would dig down to see how they were organizing their relationships and relating to one another, most of the couples were falling into what we called a gendered power imbalance. And this was limiting the ways that they could relate with each other so that they were not achieving what they really had hoped to find in their relationship, which was some kind of attuned connection with each other over time. And then in 25 years ago now, in 2000, I moved to Loma Linda University to start a doctoral program in family therapy. And at the same time, Douglas Hunegaart moved there to work in this doctoral program as well. And he and I discovered that we had a shared interest in trying to understand how to translate what we knew from lots of research about gender and power issues, but it wasn't in the clinical research very much. And so he and I started doing co-therapy and discovered that we worked intuitively pretty similarly, but we didn't know how to teach others how to address these issues. So we started inviting students to watch us. And then a few years later, we got a formal IRB approved study where it was an action research study where we were studying our own practice and the practice of our clinical research team, basically to see what worked to change these patterns in couples' relationships that we saw being replicated over and over again. And not only in students' work, but we would look at takes of our own work and we would see ways that what we were doing as therapists was inadvertently reinforcing these societal gendered power dynamics and cultural context.
Real quickly, what do you remember from your own work? I always think it's interesting. I also still study my own work and looking for these common factors, and I'll be surprised. Oh my gosh, I am doing that. And I never would have thought about that till I watched it back What were you back 25 years ago surprised to see that was so gendered in your own work or made you think about this model that you were developing?
One example would be that Doug and I were doing co-therapy. So there were the two of us, and we were working with a couple where we were already very aware that there was this imbalance between the partners. And we were inviting her to speak about some things that were very important to her and was hard for her to talk about and was very vulnerable. And all of a sudden, the male partner jumped up and said, "It's hot in here." And we immediately started focusing on him and what he was feeling and what he was experiencing. And so this was us we were already in the middle of studying these things. And there was just countless examples like that. Over the years, there have been about 60 people on our research team. And in the beginning, we were looking at video, at transcripts of therapy sessions from a number of these therapists who are doctoral students mostly. And we would find these kinds of things happening over and over again. So there was one study that was done by Jessica Chenfing and Amy Galick and Youngju King, and just looking at these transcripts and finding that therapists and female partners would step in to protect male partners. Now, as we've gone along, we found that what we've been working on is not limited to heterosexual relationships, but pretty much all relationships that are distressed, there's some kind of power imbalance going on. And it can be very hard to sort out and recognize those when you're in the heat of the moment and the emotional context of what's happening.
So listeners of our show also may think about, okay, our field has come a long way from the golden age of the 70s, where these patriarchal models usually developed by white men were mother bashing. Everybody remembers the schizophrenogenic mother. And then our field addressed that in the 80s with the feminist critique and great visionaries, people like Betty Carter, that talked about gender and power. How do you see this as building on what MFT was addressing around in our kind of postmodern age and thinking?
Building on all of it. In fact, Doug used to, before he came to Southern California, he was in Florida, and he would fly up to Washington, D.C. to have once a month to have supervision with Betty Carter. He had the direct contact with some of the Women's Project and the founders, and I was studying and reading all those things that were being done in the late 80s and early 90s about introducing the ideas, Rachel Hare Mustin, and just all kinds of people, Carol Anderson and Froma Walsh, and we could go on and on. I think it's different here of what we did was use research of clinical process to bring these insights into actual model and a plan that's centered the idea that relationships should mutually benefit and mutually support each partner. And that's what we tell our clients from the beginning. I've yet to have anybody who comes to therapy disagree with that when we ask them. And so we developed the model from the ground up using action research and grounded theory methods to help hold us accountable. And even today, when we look at videos of some of the most well-known therapists in the field, if they have published works and such, it is surprising how if you haven't brought a very intentional overarching lens about the larger context, that the interventions end up often being asking each partner to do the same thing without paying attention to the power dynamic necessarily. And so this is a model that puts what we call the circle of care, which is mutual support, at the center of it. And that organizes everything that we do.
Yeah, let's talk more about how we introduce this model. So how therapists begin using this type of language to clients who may not be familiar with the relational justice framework. And again, let's define relational justice, because not only may our clients not know what that means, sometimes some of our therapists that are doing a lot of work with couples have not thought about what that means in the context in which we're living in 2025.
We translated relational justice into four very practical components that are familiar to all therapists: mutual vulnerability, mutual attunement, mutual influence, and shared relational responsibility. I think what's different is that whenever we are, especially when we're stuck, we're always going back to how is that tracking, how that is working in the relationship. And it also begins, even before that, with therapists having to do their own awareness of these issues. There's a group of us, Jessica Chen-Singh and Lana Kim and I, have started meeting, trying to think through going forward with this model, what kind of training is necessary. And it's become clear to us in thinking about it that this isn't a model that you can just go and take a 20-hour course and I've learned these competencies and you check it off. It really has to do with self of the therapist work first and developing a way of seeing relationships as embedded in the larger societal system. Now, that's what systemic therapy is supposedly always about, but it just has become so much more clear to us. And especially some of the work also that I've been doing recently with Olga Smoliak of understanding emotion not as something that is within the individual and then it bursts forth or we access what's, quote, in there. But emotion is like an organizing process that's within our larger social structures and our social discourses. And it organizes and frames how people respond to each other and react to each other. And I think the first step for therapists is really getting that at a visceral level and then having humility about that our attempts to understand someone else's context is never a neutral process. And that when we are meeting clients for the first time and as we continue to engage with them, we are co-creating the story that they are telling us. And that's the influence, of course, from social constructionists and postmodernists. But it's making therapists both aware and then responsible for and accountable for how do the ways that I ask questions, who I focus on, what I name things, what I call things, how that helps to shape the story. And we live in such an individualistic society in the United States, especially, but increasingly around the globe. And therapists need to be, we have found, very intentional in how they bring a relational focus in. And so there a lot of what we do is drawing similarly to EFT on attachment theory and structural therapy and experiential models. But what's different is this attention and awareness that to power and that are how we are locating ourselves or positioning ourselves as the therapist in the process is there is no way to be neutral, as we're not the first ones to say. That's not new information, but we are still struggling as a field to be accountable for what that means.
Both you and I have spent our careers training therapists too, so this, it seems, a way of showing up in therapy. And if you are intentional like this, even if you come from a majority population or you have similarities with your client system where you are not thinking on these ways, it is a way of thinking about your own emerging self as a therapist. And I always say you have to buy it to sell it. So if you're not understanding how it functions for you, it's going to be hard to explain that and sell that to clients. Speaking of that, let's say I have a client in a couple system that, hey, we're coming here to work on how to deal with our kids or working on communication. There's no power imbalance here. How do you frame it in a way where one person is resistant to acknowledging a power imbalance?
From the very beginning, as I said, we are upfront about telling therapists very broadly that we work from a model that is attentive to supporting each of them. And then really paying attention to what is happening in the current process. For example, a couple comes in. I'm thinking of a case where they've come in around a gambling problem. He's lost $20,000 and they're seeing me as part of a larger problem gambling treatment program. I'm not an expert on that. And in the first, I start by asking him how gambling fits into his life. I start with what's brought them there. And he says that it makes him, it's a way of dealing with the pressure in his life, that he feels more relaxed when he's gambling and actually up until losing this money, confident. And then I turn to his wife and I say, in addition to the gambling issues, what would you like to see that's different? And she says she wishes he was home more with their young daughter. And he starts to get somewhat angry and says, why haven't you told me this before? This is news to me. I didn't know you were unhappy about these things. I interrupt that then by recognizing my CERT lens says, how is it that he wouldn't know what she was concerned about? And I basically say that back. So I'm dealing with the in-the-moment process. I'm not giving them a lecture. And I say, how did it happen that you wouldn't know what's going on? And he says, well, she should tell me. If she has a problem, that's what people do. They speak up about it. And she says, I have told you. I've tried to give you hints. And so then as a therapist, I follow that thread about hints and what happens when he doesn't hear her and backs down. And within the first 20 minutes of the therapy session, we've started to create an expectation that we're going to be looking at those communication dynamics between them and the processes that's what's happened. And then I invite them, as most therapists would, to say, would it be okay if we back up a little bit and look at some of the history? And most clients expect that. And as I'm getting their history, that turns out this is a Black couple. And we talk about how they learn to deal with discrimination in their lives and some different things, all very quickly, all within the first session. But so the point is that going back to that, what the therapist asks about and follows is going to create the trajectory for the therapy. And of course, in all our models inform what shapes the questions that therapists ask. And what we are trying to do in those, as a CERT therapist in those first sessions, is start setting the stage that the clients begin to see themselves as acting within these larger contexts. In most cases, we would call his position a more powerful position based on how we're defining power in the model, which is the ability both to influence others and to be heard and understood, and seeing that even though in this case she had a more affluent upbringing than he did and she had some social capital in the way she carried herself and asked questions, when we're tracking mutual vulnerability, mutual attunement, mutual influence, and shared relational responsibility, it starts to become clear pretty early on in the session that she's the one carrying that the sense of needing to keep the relationship going. She has her concerns, but she's primarily oriented toward supporting him. She knows what kinds of issues he struggles with in the larger society, and she doesn't pressure him too much. And neither of them is terribly attuned to the other, but she's making more efforts to trying to be attuned. And so that's a very brief example of what might happen in a first session.
So rather than, again, any specific intervention or technique, this is, as we said, more of a way of showing up. And I, on the show, often talk about one of these common factors that is MFTs, we see systems, whether it be couples or families, in these relational cycles. And I think if I'm tracking with you in your approach, is talking about this circle of care, which you mentioned. Let's see if I can remember them. Mutual influence, mutual attunement, mutual vulnerability, and this shared relational responsibility. So the CERT therapist views the couple or the family cycle through this lens and helps the couple from that approach. Do I have that right?
Exactly. And one thing that we would be careful about, especially in the early sessions, is not putting more vulnerability on the already more vulnerable partner, which I think is what tends to happen, especially in heterosexual partners where the female partner is socialized that she's supposed to be vulnerable. We're not the only ones that have done studies that show that a lot of the self-help literature and the therapy interventions, it ends up being the female partner who jumps in and is willing to do those. And then as therapists, we follow that. And we may see a lessening of conflict as a sign that things are better, when it may be that we're just replicating the societal patterns that are playing out in this couple relationship. And the same thing is true in same-sex partners, where sometimes the person who sounds most hurt and more, like I'm thinking of a female couple where one partner was really hurt and upset and had moved out of the house because the other partner had seen, run into an old boyfriend, it had been a boyfriend, and had some communication with this old boyfriend and had kept it a secret. It would be very easy for family therapists to get into the problem is that she kept it a secret, as opposed to what is it that made it so that she felt she had to keep it a secret, and that she was in the session saying, oh, I'm so sorry, I was so wrong, I'll do anything I can do to make it up to you. And she was willing to be vulnerable, and the other partner at first was not. And so it was important to us to work with that, the partner who, as we're trying to track the power processes, understand, yes, she's been hurt, and honor the violation that happened, but then expanding the lens to see how each of them has learned how to deal with their, what we call sociocultural vulnerabilities, in a different way. And one of our more recent studies that was done here at, I'm now at Lewis and Clark, or a professor emerita now at Lewis and Clark, but I did some studies with Lana Kim at Lewis and Clark, and one of our more recent papers published in 2001 was we really zeroed in and found that the critical piece about transforming the power dynamic was connecting the vulnerabilities of each person, but especially the powerful partner, the partner in a more powerful position, to this sociocultural context of that, the messages they've received about how they're supposed to be in the world, what their worth is. In this female couple, they had both received messages that said that they were less than. But one partner had responded to that by always jumping in and trying to make things nice with everybody and always smiling, and they referred to her themselves and from their other therapy that they'd had before as a caretaker, and they were framing caretaking as a bad thing. And then the other partner had responded to her sociocultural vulnerabilities by sending from herself and keeping a distance and not depending on anyone. And so we were seeing both of them through this socioculturally attuned lens, and each of them could feel like we were making an effort to get what their experience was like. And then in that context, we could talk about what does it mean to be a caregiver. And one of the kinds of interventions in our model, we have three phases developed of the model, is validating relational work. And so rather than framing caregiving as that she doesn't have enough of a self, this one partner, CERT does interventions that while we're trying to help the other partner engage more in the circle of care, that we're validating the kind of caregiving work that the other partner had been doing.
One of the things I think often comes up in couples that, hey, it's not fair. And fairness doesn't always mean everything's divided 50-50 straight down the middle. So how, when you see a couple gridlocked on what's fair, if it is imbalanced, and it'll probably, like in most of the relationships I know, including mine, somebody always does more housework. One of the partners always makes more money. It is rarely fair in a traditional sense. How do you help couples get over the idea of 50-50 fairness?
Yeah, so that's a really important question. And I think one that before we were even developing the CERT model, and I was doing this research on gender power in couples with Anne Mahoney, that was one of the things that we really had to grapple with and the couples that we were interviewing were grappling with. And I think what is so helpful about the circle of care and the CERT model is while we do look at who does the dishes and especially the meaning of those kinds of things, it's more about how people relate to each other, who's able to express what matters to them and be heard, who automatically notices and attends to the other, so that the person, what we know from research and theory about power is that when we are in a more powerful position, we tend not to notice. And so a lot of the division of labor or especially the emotional work and labor that gets done and the attending to the relationship, all the things that a more relationally oriented partner might be doing tends not to be noticed by the other partner. And so in CERT, we're making those things visible. And the other thing that we brought in from our prior research, the non-clinical research, is that the couples who had who were able to maintain an ongoing attuned communication, this was from a study that Naveen Jonathan did with me, we found that the people weren't necessarily oriented toward a 50-50 division. They were oriented to was having a conversation that they talked about their relationship. They were aware of the societal context that was around them. And they were willing to do things that didn't come naturally. A lot of us, including my own relationship too, there are certain things that I do because I do it more naturally and my husband does other things that he's better at. But a lot of those things do tend to be gendered. And we studied couples that had young children, for example. And the couples that really ended up with fathers that were very engaged with their children, they did not just do what happened naturally. They were very intentional about ways that she might step back and he would step in, but they had to talk about it and be aware of it. And so what we do then as clinicians is Kirsty Williams did a task analysis, for example, of couples who were dealing with the issue of infidelity. And one of the things that really came out in that study was in order to get to mutuality, not just in who does the dishes, but in who can speak and be heard and whose issues are shaping the relationship, it wasn't enough to just identify the inequity or the imbalance. the therapist had to open the conversation into looking at alternatives. And I think that's another piece that either doesn't happen and because it's not noticed in other models, or it happens, but people don't feel like the therapist is attuned to them, and then they become defensive and not willing to, they feel not understood, not willing to engage.
I'm wondering, as you've been moving the model forward, what are some common mistakes or miscues that systemic therapists make when trying to integrate CERT into their work?
At least in the supervision that I've been doing with people who are newer in their careers, one of the common mistakes is the fear of stepping in and intervening. And I think that it's a very fine line, but I have two recent books out where we have a whole chapter that's looking at how do we use our influence. And then I have a workbook for couples that's actually, I think, very helpful. But let me talk about the use of influence first. I think a lot of the people that I see, if they have come to see the power processes, so that's the first thing. A lot of that just gets missed because you're focusing on something else, because that's what the, if you're focusing on differentiation, you may miss how power is intersecting with differentiation, for example. But assuming that you have that background, then feeling like you can interrupt the process that's happening in a way that it still stays connected with the clients and is not necessarily imposing your agenda as the therapist, but is making space to envision, to say, what might it look like if the two of you were able, if she was able to not just hint, if she was able to speak more directly, what might you be doing that would help make that possible? And so I think that's one of the things that I've noticed. Another thing I've noticed is that it's about losing that sociocultural attunement. And so we start making interventions, trying to interrupt the power process, but the person in power feels like they're being judged or attacked or not understood. And going back to the workbook then, I had never been the kind of therapist that would assign readings or use worksheets or anything like that. But a publisher read about CERT and reached out to me and suggested a workbook for couples. Now that publisher ended up not being the publisher that published the workbook. But as I did the workbook, it's written for couples, but I think therapists will find it so helpful. In fact, that's the feedback that I'm getting, because it helps put the therapist out of the position of being the one who is knowledgeable and trying and having to, quote, teach the clients. We know in therapists, that doesn't work. We might share some things briefly with psychoeducation, or as Rhea Almeida calls it, social education. But the workbook is really designed to help set the stage so that people, it's written for couples, but it's really for anybody who's interested in a relationship, see that there's all these societal things that are working against them. And how is it that so many people end up having the same kind of problems, and how these societal pieces then intersect with whatever other histories people have, be it abuse, substance use, just the stresses and challenges and transitions of life that we all face. And I think the challenge is to keep the sociocultural attunement and attention to power going in a way that people feel validated. The workbook helps for that. And then I think if the therapist, if they're stuck, there's three fallbacks. Focus on the immediate process that's happening in the room. Go back to the relational goals and the circle of care. And I cite Salvador Minuchin sometimes. He's talked about the stroke and kick technique. the stroke being, I know how you have, it's really clear how much you love your partner. You really want her to be doing well. And yet, you know, what she just said, you're telling her that she's wrong. And so it's not losing touch with the relational ideals. But then the third piece is always keeping the accountability there and coming back to not getting just sucked into protecting the vulnerability of the more powerful partner, which is where we started with, right? I think that's a societal process that tends to replay in therapy sessions over and over again. I don't want to suggest that we always are able to transform the power imbalances. I would say most of the time we are. But I can certainly think of a number of cases. I included a couple in the guide to the step-by-step guide to therapists, where as we made these processes clear and are working with the in-session process, the partner starts to become clear that they don't have a partner that's willing to share the relational load. I even had one that I mentioned in the book who said, no, I'm not. This was a case where she wanted him to not use pot, at least not in the house. And that's what they called it, pot. And he said, no, I'm not going to do something just because she wants me to. And she and I continued to work individually. She, in that case, decided not to leave the relationship, but she was approaching the relationship differently now. She had originally come in around anxiety, and it was clear that her partner was contributing to the anxiety. And she started doing family of origin work and such. And in the end, he did agree to only smoke his pot outside. But he never became a really what we would call a relational person. But she knew what she was dealing with and she had a name for it. And then she could choose how she wanted to respond.
Both books are excellent. Again, The Step-by-Step Guide to Socio-Emotional Relationship Therapy, A Socially Responsible Approach to Clinical Practice is one. And then the workbook you mentioned, you've been so nice to share both of them with me. The workbook, which I can't wait to use with couples, and I'm going to use the other one in my supervision with my MFT students. The workbook is the Socio-Emotional Relationship Workbook for Couples, Closing the Gap Between the Relationship You Want and the Relationship You Have, both excellent fit with everything we said today. I'm going to leave you with one kind of forecasting into the future. What emerging social issues do you think will be the most important for couples therapists to address in the coming years that your model is going to have to deal with? What do you think we have on the horizon that all MFTs should know about as it relates to fairness and balance and equity?
First of all, what's really becoming clear is that this is much more than just working with couples. The ideas can be used with individuals and kids and families. But in terms of what's on the horizon, Teresa McDowell, Maria Bermudez, and I are doing a third edition of Socioculturally Attuned Family Therapy. And in the third edition, first of all, as we've been going through the literature, we are really impressed with the amount of work that's being done in terms of addressing broadly social justice issues, relational justice issues, sociocultural issues in the field of family therapy and mental health more broadly. But I think as systems therapy, there is a lot of work that's being done. We also really addressed the polarization that seems to be growing in our society and the sense of isolation that people feel. And it's relational models of therapy are needed more and more. I don't think technology is the cause. In fact, there are parts of it that can be helpful. But all these things coming together, people seem not only more isolated from each other, but mistrustful of each other. And anything that family therapists can do, and I think the CERT model is very helpful with that, to help people to reinforce the relational values that almost always people have, but the larger society is increasingly keeping people pitted against each other and separate from each other. And they really need the work that we are doing. And we're just so glad. All the colleagues, CERT, as I said, is not just mine. I've written these books now that I've retired from everyday practice and teaching. There's many people who are developing these models. And I think the work that we do makes a difference. And for therapists to really take seriously that how we position our work and to recognize that we are not neutral agents, that the work we are doing is being shaped by who pays for therapy and the diagnostic criteria and the language we can use and all of those things. So I'm really grateful to you, Eli, for sharing this time with me and an opportunity to share some of the work that I'm looking forward to so many people carrying on in their various ways and applying it to work with children as well.
Yeah, your examples were so great today. I did not ask you to talk about how this would work with children or families with teens where there's a natural power imbalance to start with, but maybe we can have you back and we can talk about that. But thank you so much, Carmen. You were a gift to our field, and I'm so glad that people now have these resources, and they're great, very practical, written in a way that a clinician can pick up and use, and also a client using the workbook, as you said, whether they're individual or couple or family, they can take and start to build these principles into their way of communicating and relating. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Eli.
Eli, back with you, bringing to a close another informative installment of the AAMFT podcast. Did you know that AAMFT is active on all your favorite social media channels? Be sure to follow us, the AAMFT, on Instagram, X, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And you want to stay up to date with everything going on in the world of AAMFT, you can always find the back installments of the podcast anywhere you find your favorite podcast. I am partial to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, but it's on Google Play, Stitcher. So please, if you're new to us, check out back installments where we tackle the latest trends and events impacting the world of systemic therapy like today. And I have a number of pioneer interviews, which is some of my favorite interviews to conduct over the years. You can drop me a line at elikaram.com, where you see everything going on in my world, including two books that are out. One for our young professionals, Marriage and Family Therapy, National Exam, Your Guide for Success. That's from Springer. And that will prepare you for the national exam, including 360 practice questions, a full-length mock exam, proven strategies and tips for test taking, and it's organized to match the domains of the licensure exam. And then, if you're interested in these common factors that we always talk about on the show, including what makes a motivated client, how you build, nurture, and repair a therapeutic alliance, how you maximize your own therapist factors. You want to check out my book, Bringing Common Factors to Life in Couple and Family Therapy from Routledge. As always, thank you so much for listening. And until next time, my friends, stay safe, stay systemic.
Stay systemic, my friend.
It's up to the Eli to plan my future. The latest insights to love. Countless family therapy. Help them feel you.
Stay systemic, my friend. To be like,
hear the latest debate with our guests and topics we illuminate. From theory to practice, there's so much to know. Join us on this journey, let the knowledge flow.
Stay systemic, my friends. I'm in the heart of therapy. Your message transcends.